Let me just talk to you this morning about this matter of personal discipleship. It began that way, you know. God dealing with man personally and individually. And so he spoke to Adam, spoke to Eve. And he also addressed Cain and Abel according to the situation. And what that says is that's the way it still is. He may not personally direct his very voice to us, but his word is here. And the Bible is personal. I've often said that it's as if it had been put in your mailbox with your name on it. That is the inference of it. So we need to take this business personally. We often say, well, don't take it personally. God is saying, take it personally. Take it personally. Being a disciple is a personal matter. It has to be a personal matter because God made us like himself. Genesis 1, 26 and 27, he made us in his own image as persons, as individuals. Individual because we have a will of our own. And our lives are to be a product of choices that we make. So that God cannot deal with us on any other level than the personal level. So, Jeremiah 29:11-13. For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord. Thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope. Then you will call upon me and pray to me, and I will answer. And you will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. Does that sound personal? It is. It's personal with God. And it must be personal with us. That's the reason it is right for us to say, when Jesus invites us to follow him, let's follow him. Draw near to God, James said, and he will draw near to you. That is what this is about. And God certainly did draw near to us in the first place. Nearer than hands and feet, nearer than our very breath, and his son came into the world. But if the call to us is personal, as it absolutely is, come follow me, it is a call and invitation that we can accept or reject. God cannot compel us. That's an interesting thing. God cannot lie, and God can't make you do anything. Because you have a will of your own. And the great thing that God did when he worked out this magnificent, remarkable, incredible plan to bring men who had departed from him back to himself, he exercised more power and wisdom in that effort than he ever exercised in creating the whole universe or even in maintaining it, because all he has to do with that is just do it. No flower, no plant, no animal ever says no. But we say no. And we can say no and shake our fist in his face. And he's patiently endured that through these years. But this is the only way it can be done. And it's a personal business. We are not a part of some large biological machine. We're not cogs in something like that. Each one of us, and this is remarkable to us because here we have trouble. I'm having trouble now keeping the names of 50 people in my head when I want to have them. And God knows everybody, counts the hairs of the head. And the reason he does is because he values everybody. This is such a personal business, this matter of becoming a disciple of Jesus Christ. And it always will be. I make this statement now, and I make it advisedly, but I think it's true, that at last the Bible is addressed to individuals. I know Moses spoke to the nation of Israel, in his great farewell address recorded in Deuteronomy. I know that. But in the final analysis, it was addressed to each individual Israelite, to what they were going to do and how they were going to handle this business of going into this new land. And of course, Paul wrote to churches. But when Paul wrote to churches, although there were admonitions about collective action within those letters, nonetheless, he's addressing himself to individual disciples and what they're going to do about their daily lives and about their life together in local assemblies. We spoke yesterday about the all-encompassing nature of discipleship, that we have to die absolutely, totally. The Lord didn't come just to cut down the grass or lop a few limbs off the tree. He came to kill us, that old man. As Frank said so aptly last evening, the self is what's killing us. That's the poison in the bloodstream. It has to go. And it has to be replaced with the Lord so that we live the Christ life. But if that is the case, if discipleship is all-encompassing, then that means it happens all the time. In every conscious moment, discipleship is going on. And if not, then we have work to do. And I admit that sometimes I nod off and get not as attentive as I need to be. And I have occasion often to say, Lord, forgive me. I mean, I wasn't paying any attention. I just put it on automatic pilot going out and doing these things. And I wasn't thinking about you. And that's wrong for me. I know we cannot have the conscious, maybe, thought of God every single moment. But he needs to be there, and Christ needs to be there. If we're going to be his disciples, that needs to be the reference point. I call it the default. That is that good. I'm not much of a computer wonk at all. In fact, I'm the furthest thing from it. But I think God must be the default. We always go to him. Christ must be the center. We always go to him when we come to the decisions that have to be made in life. And that encompasses every conscious moment of our lives. Now, I want to make this statement. I believe it's accurate too. Most of what we do as his disciples, we do as individuals, not in the collective function of local churches. Think about how much time you spend together here with each other. And compare that with the time you spend working with your family, dealing with other individuals, just being alone, whatever the case. And the time is quite large which we spend with ourselves and quite small comparatively which we spend with each other. Now, it is important that we do that. God has made this arrangement. The local church is a blessing. It's not my subject here. That's Frank's business, and I'm trying to stay out of his business. But it's a school for saints, but individually, this is my task, and my task to stress for all of us here that we need to be engaged as Christians every moment that we live. And in all that we do, as Paul so ably stressed it both in Ephesians, especially in Colossians and also in Ephesians, whatever we do unto the Lord. He is before us. And I don't care how picayune, how apparently inconsiderable may be something that we are doing. It needs to be done heartily as unto the Lord and with a view to serving him, so that I say to people, look, don't talk to me about how you wish you could serve the Lord all the time and not be like you are. You're working for Walmart. Have to be a greeter for Walmart. That's my ambition. One of these days I'll be a greeter for Walmart. I'd like to serve the Lord all the time. What do you mean? But you are. You labor with your hands a thing that is good that you may have wherewith to give to those that have need, as Paul says in Ephesians 4. Are you not working for the Lord? Are you not working for the Lord in everything? Or so it ought to be. And if it's the Lord's work we're involved in, then we need to be careful that we are walking according to that great master's instruction, and that his will is being done. There's a tragedy, it seems to me, in the view that most, if not all, of our discipleship is lived out collectively in the local church. I can remember when we were told that we, when we got through giving on the first day of the week, ought not to have any money left over to give to anybody. Where did we get that? from the notion that that's all the giving we've got to do. Lay by in store on the first day of the week for the function of the local church, and we are through. We are not through. That's just one facet of it. The truth is, every dime I have belongs to Him, and He lets me use some of it to feed myself and to clothe my family and get shelter, and He expects that, but it's His. I am His steward. And therefore, the money that I have, the energy that I have, every possibility that's in me belongs to Him and has to be used accordingly. But our language is often churchy. I don't want to get on this too much, but converted to the church. He was converted to the church. But the church is people like me. I don't want any converts. Not for me, because I've messed things up somehow. But the Lord will never do it. And so we are converted to Christ and faithful to the church. We say faithful to the church. I hope not always, because some churches go crazy. And if you wander off after that, then you're in trouble. Faithful to the Lord. A good church worker. He's a good church worker. Instead of, he's a true servant of Christ. Really diligent. And I think that wouldn't be too difficult for us to change, but the focus of our minds must be changed, and then that will go. That will go. We certainly want to be loving toward each other and committed toward each other to do what is good and to love others even better than ourselves, but converted to someone, the center of our lives, always Christ. Now, what happens in local churches is a function of what? What is it that determines what happens when local churches come together? Brother, that's right. I determine that in my individual life. It's what we bring to these meetings. It's from what we are. From what we are constantly, from what we are daily, that makes the difference. And sometimes we forget. I've been saying this until it's gotten to be kind of burdensome to me to repeat it, but I've said you cannot create life by stacking corpses together. And if you bring a group of spiritual corpses together, that's what you got. We can help each other grow stronger, and that's the Lord's intention for the local church. But nonetheless, if we don't bring anything to these assemblies as individual disciples and saints, there is not going to be anything there. And I will tell you, I believe that personal evangelism is an individual business, basically. I don't think it can be otherwise. Somebody said, well, the preachers, after all, they're evangelists, they ought to do it. Don't make the mistake of leaving personal evangelism to preachers. That's a bad mistake. We'll do what we can. But believe you me, if that's all, if it's just the preachers out there doing it, it won't get done. It will not get done. Even working at their best, and sometimes we don't work at our best. Sometimes we get locked into this pulpit and think this is where it happens. It's right here. And of course, we're forgetting that that's not where it all happens. It's not even where most of it happens necessarily. We're talking to each other many times in the local assembly. But out there, that's where the people are. David Lipscomb had a young man come into his office in Nashville and said, Brother Lipscomb, I need a place to preach. He went to the window and threw up the shade and said, there it is. There it is. Good answer. But the failures of local churches are individual failures. Do you follow what I'm saying? The individual failures of individuals create failures in local churches. And growth in local churches, that happens when you grow and I grow. Grow up into the Lord, as the fourth chapter of Ephesians, Paul says that so aptly. That's what we are to do, grow up into the Lord. I have more to say about that tomorrow. But there's no way in the world that I can be stultified spiritually on dead center, and you can't stay there because either you grow or you die. And then expect to come together in the local church and have a living body. And somebody said, but I don't have much to do with that. You know, my part is so small. I don't believe that's what the Lord said. I don't believe that's what Paul said in the 12th chapter of Romans. when he says that each one of us has been given a measure of faith. That's what he says in verse 3 of the 12th chapter. For I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. And I don't think we should limit that to the local church function. That's been given to us to do. Now, we have different abilities. I'm glad. I'd be so sad if the whole church were the mouth. All we get done is talk. But there are other things that are equally vital. Preachers ought to be ashamed of wondering when someone comes forward in the assembly to become a Christian, well, what did I say today? What did I do today that brought this individual to become a Christian? Maybe nothing at all. It may have been the work of some humble, earnest saint whose godly ways and patient teaching produced it. But we're talking about individuals now. We're talking about what happens out there in the workaday world. We're talking about what happens to you when you're at the workplace, when you're in your home, when you meet people. And, you know, we sometimes look at people, and I'm guilty too, like they were a great inconvenience. I see these people going through that grocery line that says 10 items, and they got 20. What an aggravation. I don't think about that person as a possible Christian. Jesus would have thought about that person as a possible disciple, wouldn't he? At the grocery store or wherever else I happen to be. But people are an inconvenience, you know. You have to speak to them if you have any conversations or get anything going. And you have to ask about how they're doing. Ask about them. What's going on? Let me get acquainted with you. You have to do that. You have to engage people, even in a quiet way. People can do it very quietly, because they're interested in other people. That happens all the time. And that's where personal evangelism happens. But I'll tell you, the thing I know about myself is I have to be deeply concerned about people. And the Lord has to put in me a deep compassion and a deep conviction that these people are lost. Not just lost in the woods, but lost from God. And there is no crisis that's worse than that. There is no man who's fallen among thieves and been beaten and left and robbed who's in worse shape than this. Is it possibly in as bad a shape as a person who's out there unsaved? So take it into consideration here that Paul says you have your measure of faith. And the question is, am I exercising that so that the body will be what it needs to be? Do not discount what you can do. Listen to me. You are an instrument of God. And he knows what you can do, like he knew what Moses could do when Moses said, I can't talk. I'm not the man. And God told him in no uncertain terms, I know who you are, and I know what you can do. You go speak to the Pharaoh. And if you're too bashful to do it, well, then Aaron will help you. But it has to come from us. It cannot be generated from evangelists, though they can help, because they're members of the body. And elders can do their part to lead and to shepherd, a very significant part. But your part is significant too, and I speak to this morning to our godly women. Let me tell you, you are a very significant part of the function of God's people and everything that's important to it, and I want you to know that I know it. We could not ever do it without you. Your function is vital. And so there's the body, individual personal discipleship that functions at every level, but individually especially, because that's where we are most of the time, and certainly in the local church. But we're talking about how we can grow up. There's no way in the world the churches will ever be alive if we ourselves are dead. And we can't expect just to be dead, but the other people are alive, so they'll carry us on. Well, of course, that may be true. But what's going to happen at last? Let me take you just quickly to the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount, you notice, is addressed to individuals. There isn't any instruction in the Sermon on the Mount about collective church function. That doesn't mean that that's unimportant. It just means that what Jesus was reaching for in that great sermon was the heart of the matter. And he's talking to us as individuals. He starts out with our attitude toward God and toward ourselves and toward others in those great Beatitudes. And I want to tell you something. If you want to be proud and haughty and self-willed, forget about being a disciple of Jesus. That sort of stuff wreaks havoc in local churches and everywhere else, in families, in all relationships. It's poison. But we have to be brokenhearted and empty and recognize our emptiness and recognize our need. Poor in spirit, meek, hunger for righteousness. That speaks about somebody who knows his failures, who accepts them and doesn't want to continue and can do that. Why? Because God says, I can change all that. And so we've got to come with that attitude. And then Jesus says something remarkable. He said, you are the light of the world. You're the salt of the earth. He didn't say you will be. Maybe one day you'll get that way. He says you are. People with that attitude, let me tell you, people with that attitude have about them the light that comes down from heaven. Well, they're humble people. And they're selfless people. And they're people that care for others and will sacrifice for them. Who don't have to have their way. And who don't have to try to be somebody all the time. Listen, you're already somebody. Made in the image of God. And forgiven by His grace. You're a disciple of Jesus Christ. How big do you want to get? It's like Robert Turner said. After you become a Christian, there's no step above that except the Lord Himself. And so with that attitude, the light begins to shine. Now, I want to tell you that passage that talks about being the light of the earth and the salt of the earth and the light of the world is not talking about personal evangelism per se, that is, talking to people. Because Jesus said that men, seeing your good works, will glorify your Father who is in heaven. You think that's not important? You think that's not significant in terms of reaching other people? It is. I mean, there's nothing like seeing the finished product, or at least one on the way, to draw somebody to the gospel. What is it about these people that makes them so calm when tragedy has blasted them? What is it about these people that always makes them concerned about others and so unconcerned about themselves? What is it about these people that creates such joy in them, no matter what? What is it about them that causes them to think so dearly of each other and to be open to other people? People that are sorry, people that are messed up, people that are dragged down and they care. Listen, don't think that you can get a Cracker Jack personal evangelism kit that's going to overcome the absence of that. So, we become the light of the world and the salt of the earth. And he says that you need to pay attention to my Father's word like I do. Because every last word, every jot and tittle of the law and the prophets is going to be fulfilled. I'm going to fulfill it. That's the big thing. And why? Because it's true. It's God's word. It's my Father's word. That's his attitude toward the scriptures. Frank said last night, once you decide who Jesus is, everything else comes together so far as the Bible is concerned. And not only that, he said, you need to remember that you can't leave out anything that God has said and commanded. For if you break the least of these commandments and teach men so, you should be called least in the kingdom of God. And that doesn't mean you're going to have to sit in the bleachers, but you'll be there. It means you ain't going to be there at all. That's what it means. Because your attitude is bad. You just want to pick and choose. You haven't become a disciple of anybody but yourself. You've decided what you like and what you don't like. And we're all guilty of that sometimes. I don't like that. Oh, well, okay, you don't like it. Now, why don't you like it? Is it because it's not from God? Is it because it's not in the book? Is it because it has nothing to do with Christ? Or is it because it has everything to do with Christ and you just don't like it? Because it's biting in a place you don't want to be bitten. Well, we have to pay attention to everything. There's no list that you can get up that these are the things that are important. If God said it, if he's instructed us, if it applies to us out of the context, obviously, then we need to pay attention to that. That's an attitude toward God. And then the whole, the rest of the chapter is talking about loving your neighbor like yourself. Talks about what you ought not do if you love your neighbor. Talks about what you're going to have to do if you've done something wrong to your brother. You're going to have to go take care of it. You can't just say, well, I did something wrong. I'll ask the Lord to forgive me. But I can't speak to him. I can't speak to him about that. No. I just can't do it. Yes, you can, and you must. Otherwise, your worship to God is nullified for the rest of your life. And then he says, and when people do mean things to you, you're supposed to do good things to them. You think that's not tough? That's tough. I think it's easy when I can't think of any enemies I've got, but when I've got one, it's not as easy. When somebody seems to major in just making my life miserable, am I more concerned about the fact he's making my life miserable, or am I more concerned about the fact that he's lost and he's going to be undone and destroyed because of this? That's the challenge. And to pray for him and to do good. That's what it says about the way you live your life as a disciple. And the whole of the sixth chapter is about putting God first instead of yourself, trying to get out in front and let everybody see how righteous you are and good you are, like the Pharisees were. They did everything so men could see them. And Jesus said that they got what they wanted. They've been seen, and that's it. But if you want God to hear you, if you want God to receive you, if you want to have fellowship with him and be close to him, then pay attention to him and think about him and not yourself when the time comes to give and when it comes to praying and when it comes to fasting, of course, which was a thing that was done in those days, and it was done in the apostolic days too. I don't know there's any institutionalized fast according to the New Testament, but we know they did fast occasionally when they prayed, and we ought not to run away from that. But anyway, then the next thing he says you got to be careful of is trying to make your treasure here. And that's so subtle. We live in a tub of butter in this place. My. And never have people had so much and complained so much about having so little. That's the way it happens. But the treasure you put here is gone. I mean, you don't keep it. You're not going to stay here. Let God be the one you're concerned about. Put your mind on him. Let him be first in your life. And then another thing, of course, that was mentioned last night too. Anxiety for things. You might as well love things as to be anxious about whether you're going to have enough, because it captures your mind, doesn't it? If you're trying to have more and more, that's got your mind instead of God. And if you're worried about whether you're going to have enough, that's got your mind and not God. And besides all that, you're saying to God, look, I know you promised that you would never leave me or forsake me, but I don't believe it. I'm scared to death. I'm not going to have enough. You just like those disciples. I'm just like those disciples in that boat. You've got the Son of God sitting here, who has all power, and you've confessed him as the Son of God, and yet you're frightened to death that you're going to die of drowning right here. Oh, you have little faith, he said. Don't let that happen to you. The central theme of that great sermon is seek first the kingdom of God. I don't believe that's the church there. I believe it's the reign of God. Then you say, look at the context. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. All these things will be added to you. We're in a great fever to be happy sometimes. You can't be happy by trying to be happy. You don't get anything like that. God will take care of that. What you need to take care of, what I need to take care of, is the business of serving the great God. Forgetting about myself and serving God and serving Christ. That needs to take me up completely. And if that happens, I will tell you something. You will find happiness. You will find joy. You will find everything you ever wanted. But it doesn't come by approaching it directly. And sometimes why am I not happy? Why am I not? Well, are you serving God like you ought to? Have you given your heart to it? All right, I'm pushing my luck here. I'm winding up. Well, the last part of the Sermon on the Mount just says, just got two choices. You can either go the narrow way to life or you can go the broad way to destruction. And of course, he's saying, take the narrow road. Or you can either build on a solid rock, or you can build on the sand. You can either hear my words and do them, or you can hear my words and not do them. Only two choices. And he's appealing to us to build on the rock. So when that great storm breaks, it will stand.
Well, all I'm saying to you, and I'm going to be finished now, is we're going to think about growing, then the way we need to do it is deal with ourselves. I know you'd love to help these other people. Doesn't do a lot of good to complain about them. You know what the disciples did when the Lord said to them that fateful night before he died? He said, one of you is going to betray me. I believe it's Mark's account that tells us that each one by one, began to say, is it I? I mean, these guys all thought it might be a possibility. They didn't deny the possibility that they might be betraying the Lord. So, am I growing like I ought to? Am I reaching for more like Paul in the third chapter of Philippians? Am I the one that comes and sits down at his table in his kingdom and eats with him and then goes out and act a fool, be indifferent, and not grow? Because I will tell you this, you know it already. The only person that you can absolutely change is yourself. And that's where our energies need to be placed as we seek to be the true disciples of the Lord. Thank you.